Hi there and welcome. This is Amanda, the founder of Astrology Hub, and you're listening to our Week Ahead Snapshot with world-class astrologer, historian, and author of The Cosmic Calendar, Christopher Renstrom. This show is designed to give you a quick overview of the week ahead, enabling you the gift of choice in how you navigate and weave these energies into your daily life. Enjoy.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Astrology Hub's Inner Circle. Awaken your soul, find connection, and transform your life with the world's top astrologers in a heart-centered community.
Hello, my name is Christopher Renstrom, and I'm your weekly horoscope columnist here on Astrology Hub. And this week, I wanted to talk to you about Mars in Cancer trining Saturn in Pisces on March 30th. Now, what's remarkable about this particular trine, aside from the fact it's the first major trine taking place with Saturn having entered the zodiac sign of Pisces, what's remarkable about this trine is that it involves the two malefics in astrology. Malefics in astrology are planets which kind of have a reputation for doing bad things. Now, it's not completely deserved, but it sort of is, hard to deny, okay? Mars is a planet which is often associated to being aggressive and angry and combat. And we get that because Mars is named after the Roman god of war. And Saturn is associated with being old and crotchety and restrictive and controlling and miserly, both emotionally and financially. And we get that from Saturn being named after the Roman god of time. So here they are forming a trine in the zodiac signs of Cancer and Pisces. And a trine is a good thing. Why is a trine a good thing? A trine is a good thing because when planets are trining, they are in two zodiac signs that share the same element. So that what that creates is a kind of harmony. It's a rapport. It's an understanding between the two planets. And even in their trine aspect, it has a tendency to bring out the better part of the two planets rather than the negative. So for those of you who often say, what could be good about Mars? What could possibly be, wonderful about Saturn? Well, this week, they're going to show off their kinder and their gentler dispositions. What I'm going to do is actually share with you the story of one of my favorite films. I love this film so much. It's one of my favorite films. It's called Now Voyager. It was made in 1942, I believe. And it starred Betty Davis. It's one of Betty Davis's best movies ever. Okay, it stars Betty Davis, Paul Henri, and Claude Rains, who's one of the most unsung actors in Hollywood nowadays, a real genius. And he was really brilliant with his career and did so many great roles. But anyway, okay, so it's Betty Davis, it's Paul Henri, and it's Claude Rains. They star in this film. And it is called Now Voyager. Now Voyager basically is Washington Square. If you're familiar with the book Washington Square by Henry James, it's basically Washington Square, but told by a woman. Okay, it's a woman's version of Washington Square. And so there's much more of psychology and depth to it. And in Washington Square, it's an heiress who comes from a very well-to-do family who's dominated by her father. And in Now Voyager, it is an heiress who is dominated by her tyrannical mother. She hails from the Boston Vales. The Vales are evidently the most prominent family in Boston. And so Charlotte Vale is played by Betty Davis. So as I talk to you about this film, what I want to demonstrate is a few things. The big thing I want to demonstrate is actually how a Mars and Saturn trine works, because I think in the narration of the film, it really demonstrates that. Mars and Saturn, as I said before, are associated with being malevolent planets, but in their aspect of a trine, they're actually very positive. But in their being positive, they never lose their Marsiness and they never lose their Saturnness. Okay, so there's a kind of tough love thing that combines with self-championship against staggering odds, which are associated to these two planetary energies. The other planetary energies that I want you to listen for in the story that I'm about to tell you is the moon, because the moon, obviously, is the ruler of the zodiac sign of Cancer. Mars is in Cancer. So you're going to hear some very strong lunar themes. The other theme that you're going to hear is Pisces. And Pisces, as we know, has two ruling planets, its ancient ruler, which is Jupiter, and its modern ruler, which is Neptune. And all of these themes of the moon, Jupiter, and Neptune are going to come forth in the story of Now Voyager. What we see is actually how malefics in trine give us fortitude and perseverance to go through very staggering challenges. In this case, because we're dealing with water sign, in the story of Now Voyager, it's more psychological difficulties and psychological challenges that have to be faced, that have to be owned. And the victory isn't a fiery victory where, you know, I won the guy and I get to celebrate this in triumph, or I won the money and I'm a... No, it's not a fiery triumph. It's a personal, a psychological, and really, it's a triumph of the soul. And that's something that I want you to listen to as we begin our story. Now, at the start of the film, we see a Boston mansion, modern day, it's 1940s, and it's raining. And inside, the servants are getting ready for a visitor who's showing up. And the visitor is Ilka Chase, who's like one of my favorite like side actresses ever. Okay, the visitor is like Ilka Chase, who plays the daughter-in-law to the matron of this Boston family, the Vales, who's played by Gladys Cooper. And so Ilka Chase shows up with Claude Rains, who plays a psychologist. And they've shown up because Ilka Chase has beseeched Claude Rains, who's the psychiatrist. His name is Dr. Jackwith. She has beseeched Dr. Jackwith, who's the foremost famous psychiatrist in America at this time, to come and examine her sister-in-law, Charlotte Vale. Now, Charlotte lives in this house, which is a very, very wealthy house, but it's very cold and it's very austere house. And her mother is really this tyrannical woman, very understated, almost skeletal in appearance. The hair is drawn back severely. The skin is very sharp and crisp. You know, she's older and she's unyielding in every aspect of her appearance and in every aspect of her manner. She speaks in a very brusque, sharp, clipped manner. And so the sister-in-law has brought this famous psychiatrist to the house. It's kind of an intervention, actually, is what it is. And so they have this first conversation where the sister-in-law is saying, you know, what's going to go on? And Dr. Jackwith says, yes, I'm a psychologist, and I'm here to examine your daughter, Charlotte, who has been reported to me is very troubled. And the mother says, you know, no matter what Lisa might have told you, my daughter is no more ill than a molting canary. Okay, so that's basically her view of psychology at that point. And so the doctor says, well, I understand that that's what you think, but, you know, please, what I'm going to ask you to do is not refer to me as a doctor, refer to me as Mr. Jackwith, and let's just have a casual, relaxed conversation with your daughter, Charlotte, so I can examine her and see what's going on. And the mother's like, very well. And she's like, Charlotte, Charlotte, you know, she calls up. And so, you know, at first you see Betty Davis plays Charlotte Vale. At first you see her feet coming down the stairs, and what you see right away are these like old shoes and these stockings, you know, and you're like, oh my goodness, what's coming down the stairs? And so there's, you know, that famous down the stairs shot, you know, so you just see the feet coming down the stairs, and then you see Charlotte emerge. And Charlotte is 25 pounds, 30 pounds overweight. Her hair is combed, you know, out of the parted in the middle and tied tautly on both sides. She wears glasses and she has this unibrow, and she's wearing the most unflattering frumpy dress that you could possibly imagine. And she looks dreadful. I mean, she looks dreadful. And so the doctor sees her, you know, and the mother says, Charlotte, come over here. And basically, the mother does all the talking, you know, and she says, basically, you know, this is my daughter, and she's my sole companion. And, you know, she takes care of me and I control the finances. She basically outlines the fact that, you know, this is an only daughter who is essentially an unwanted child who's going to take care of the mother in her old age and probably inherit everything. But in the process, the mother has completely tyrannized her. There is no youth in her look. There's no spontaneity in the way that she acts. She's really like a beaten and obedient dog. And this is what emerges. And so they're having this conversation. The doctor's asking questions. And of course, Charlotte isn't answering a single one of them. And, you know, the mother then says, you know, listen, Charlotte, you have to participate in this conversation. After all, this is a doctor. This is a doctor who's come here to examine you, see whether you're mentally ill or not, whether you're going to have a mental breakdown. Do you think you're going to have a mental breakdown, Charlotte? You know, and Charlotte, of course, and you know, Dr. Jackwith is like, great, okay, that one like went out the window, you know, and the mother, of course, has deliberately spoiled it because she's exercising her dominance over her daughter. As they talk amongst themselves and the sister-in-law sort of picks up the conversation, Charlotte departs and the doctor departs with her. And she goes up the stairs and the doctor follows her. And he's like, I'm wondering if you might not be able to give me a tour of the house. You know, and she just sort of like says a few perfunctory remarks and he's like, well, can I see the room that you live in? You know, and so she lets the doctor into her room, and immediately what the doctor spies on her drawing room desk, her bedroom desk, is these ivory boxes that she carves, this extraordinary filigree, this beautiful detail. And the doctor notices that and he's like, where did you get these? And she's like, well, I made them. And he's like, these are astonishing. I mean, look at the craftsmanship of this. Look at the detail. And he's not just saying that to be a good therapist. They're really quite exquisite. They're really quite gorgeous. And they are, of course, an expression of Charlotte's stifled creativity. And so they begin talking about that. And Charlotte begins to open up. And at that point, you know, the doctor is kind of examining the room and he sees that there's in the waste paper basket are some tissues, and he looks around the tissues and there are some snubbed cigarettes that Charlotte smokes in her room, you know, and he notices that the books are arranged in such a way as to hide things. And basically, and this is very Mars in Cancer, it's the hiding, the covering of the traces that's going on. And so, you know, he examines these things and he's trying to make her feel comfortable. And then all of a sudden, she just has this outburst about her mother and how her mother dominates every aspect of her life. And there's not anything that she can do without, you know, her mother, you know, her mother's approval or her mother's interference. And there's nothing about her, you know, that's sacred or private to her, you know. And so the doctor's like, okay, well, okay, I touched a nerve, you know. And, you know, he's like, well, maybe we'll go back downstairs and join your mother and your sister-in-law. And so she does. And so there's another family relative who joins them. It's actually the sister-in-law's daughter who's downstairs and who's kind of like having part of the conversation. She's very buoyant, very blonde, very pretty, very everything that Charlotte should be. Okay, she's amusing, she's buoyant, and Charlotte is absolutely this beaten down Aunt Charlotte, this spinster Aunt Charlotte. And so the niece begins to make fun of Charlotte, you know, because everyone in the family makes fun of Charlotte. This is the member of the family that everyone dominates, that everyone verbally and emotionally abuses, because there's always that scapegoat that often shows up in families, and Charlotte is hers. And so the niece is making fun of her, and Charlotte, you know, all of a sudden just breaks down and says, you know, stop it, stop it, stop making fun of me, stop treating me like a monkey, you know, and she breaks out of the room, you know, in tears. And you know, the mother looks after her and she's like, well, whatever happened? And you know, they're like, and the niece is like, well, I didn't mean to. I mean, it's not anything like I haven't done before or whatever. And the doctor looks at the mother and the mother says, no member of the Vail family has ever had a nervous breakdown. And Dr. Jackwith shoots back, well, there's one having one now. So the mother gets up out of the chair to confront the doctor, you know, to dominate him. And the doctor, you know, stands his ground, locking eyes on her. And he says, my dear Miss Vail, if you had deliberately and maliciously planned to destroy your daughter's life, you couldn't have done it more completely. And on that line, the scene ends. And what happens is that Charlotte goes to his sanitarium. He runs a sanitarium, which is kind of like on this ranch. And she goes to his sanitarium to recover. And what he's basically done is removed her from this Boston house to his sanitarium. And there she begins to build up her confidence. There she begins to get more of her sense again, more of a sense of herself again. And she does therapy with him. She's doing psychotherapy with him. And he finds out about an affair that she had had, or not an affair, that she had, you know, was making out with a cruise director or something like that when she and her mother took a cruise when she was younger, and the mother went looking for where her daughter was with the captain because she's got all of this money, and they find them making out in the back of the car. You know, that's on this cruise ship, kind of like Titanic, I think. But, you know, but it's 1940s, but they're making out of the back of the car. And so it's really humiliating. And the cruise director says, well, I intend to marry your daughter. And you know, the mother's like, he said, well, she has a CRISPR delivery, but it's like hell you are. You're not marrying into the Vail family, but she quashes it. And so by doing this, she has intruded on Charlotte's sexuality. She's intruded on her spirit, and she's intruded on who she is. And what we see here with Mars and Cancer, what I find fascinating is that Bette Davis is an Aries, so her ruling planet is Mars. So, and we're talking about a Mars and Cancer trining Saturn and Pisces. What we see here with the Mars and Cancer is difficulty. Mars is in its fall in the zodiac sign of Cancer. So it's very difficult for people with Mars and Cancer to express their anger outwardly, you know. It's also very difficult for them to feel legitimate or like it's all right to express the anger. Of course, Mars being in the zodiac sign of Cancer, Cancer is the zodiac sign of the mother, and it is also the zodiac sign of hearth and home and family. So here, where we've seen this mother's dominance of her daughter, all of the anger has been turned inward into herself. Okay. And so, and what's really wonderful about Bette Davis's performance is that not only do you see this self-loathing, which is there, you see the very slow healing of it. It's not done, and it never actually ever goes away. And this is really remarkable about Davis's performance in this film, how shaded and how subtle it is. And by keeping in mind that this is talking about Mars and Cancer, you can actually really have an appreciation for what she's doing here. The anger has been turned in on herself. She tries to keep it lit on it. And because she doesn't own the Mars, and this is what happens with Mars in a horoscope, because she doesn't own the Mars, because she doesn't say, I'm angry, I'm pissed off, and you know, family, because she doesn't own the Mars, she becomes an object of hostility and derision in her own family. So part of that is because the mother dominates her daughter and everyone else feels free to do the same. Obviously, they're getting cues from the mother to do that. But more than that, if you don't own Mars in your own horoscope, if you're disassociated from it, if you're disconnected from it, and a Mars in fall is turned in on itself, then that gives a kind of psychic wink to people to take out their hostility on you, to single you out for your hostility, for their hostility. And this can often happen in Mars and Aries, but particularly Mars and Aries kind of has it to an extent, sort of. What really happens in is Mars in Cancer and also Mars in Scorpio. I haven't really seen it show up as much with Mars in Pisces, but it definitely shows up with Mars in Cancer and Mars in Scorpio, because emotionally, it is so upsetting to get angry that the anger is turned in on the self. And that, of course, causes more upset or depression. Both of these things Charlotte Vail is suffering from. And this is why she's at the sanatorium. So she's at this sanatorium. And after a few weeks in the sanatorium, the doctor says, well, it's time for you to return home. And she's like, she's completely crestfallen and upset. And the sister-in-law has come there to sort of collect Charlotte and take her home. And she's like, please don't. I don't, you know, and the doctor's like, you've made so much progress. You're standing on your own. You're discovering yourself. And she's like, no, I cannot go back into that house. Please, please don't make me go back into that house. You know, and the two of them, you know, shoot each other a glance and they turn to her and said, well, actually, we've made other plans for you. And she's like, what plans? And they tell her that they've booked, the sister-in-law tells her, I have booked you on a cruise for 6 months through South America. And Charlotte's like, what? And she's like, I booked you on a cruise for 6 months down in South America. I wanted you to be able to have this time away to get a sense of who you are. And she looks at the doctor and she's like, you knew about this? And he's like, yes, yes, I knew about this. And I think it's the perfect intermission. It's the perfect in-between time. This allows you to take the skills that you've learned here at the sanatorium to work on the things that we've worked on in therapy and to develop really your social skills with people. You're not going to know anyone on this cruise. They're not going to know you. And she's like, how are they not going to know me? I'm Vail. I mean, they know the Vails of Boston. And they're like, well, we've actually booked you under an alias, Rene Bouchon. And she's like, Rene, and you're like, Rene Bouchon. Because I don't know, everyone's got a French name when it's an alias in Hollywood of the 1940s. But anyway, she's booked under an alias, which is Rene Bouchon. And you're going to be booked under Rene Bouchon, and no one will know you. And this will give you an opportunity to socialize outside the home, outside the sanitarium, to put into play these skills that we've worked on. And so she's happy, but anxious. I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, a 6 month cruise is a 6 month cruise, but you're off on your own and you've always lived in a house and dominated by your mother. It's kind of like, wow, this is like being thrown into the deep end, but that's what they do. All right. So what Dr. Jackwith does, though, is that he gives her a poem, a little slip of paper, and it's a poem. And it's a poem from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And it's called The Untold Want. And she opens up the paper and she reads it. And it says, The Untold Want, by life and land never granted. Now, Voyager, sail forth to seek and find. And it's a wonderful poem if you think about it, because it's the untold want. And untold can mean too much, you know, an untold amount of money was spent, or an untold is not shared. It's not told. It's not narrated to you. So the untold want by life and land never granted. Okay. You're not going to get that in your life or your life on land, basically. Now, Voyager, sail forth to seek and find. And it's wonderful there, because what you get is the Jupiter and the Neptune rulership of Pisces. Okay, you get Jupiter's voyage. Okay, Jupiter is the planet of long journeys and voyages that take you to lands where you've never been before. Okay, so this is the voyage. This is the journey, which is Jupiter, which is the co-ruler of Pisces. And then we have Neptune, which is, of course, it's an ocean liner. So it's a voyage overseas. So she's embarking overseas to really experience the world for the first time outside of her Boston community, outside of the dominance of her mother's tyranny. She's going to go and experience the world as an adult, as this person emerging from psychotherapy. She's going to go and experience the world like this. And with that, With that, Charlotte Vale's journey begins. So then we cut to the cruise ship, okay? And there's a bunch of tourists, and they're all, like, really annoyed. They're all, like, you know, they're all annoyed, and they're arguing with, you know, the person who's going to be leading them out on their cruise that day, their tour that day. They're on the ship, and they're going to disembark from the ship and get these cars and go out and see the sights. But they're all, like, annoyed and really flustered because there's this person who's keeping them all waiting, this person who's late. They want to get to the cars. They want to go and do their shopping and see the sights and things like that. And everyone is waiting on this woman, you know, and they're like, who is it? And it's like, oh, this woman, you know, her name. Her name is Renee Bouchon. And so all of a sudden they're like, oh, you know, one of them, like, there she is. And so they look up and there's, like, you know, a staircase or whatever. And what happens is that the camera, you know, focuses in on the shoes. Okay, but instead of the old matronly shoes that we saw in the Boston home, we see these. Oh, it's so fantastic. I mean, if anything, you just have to go on YouTube to watch this scene. But this shot, okay, it zeroes in on these black and white shoes, which are so fashionable and so chic and so fabulous. It zeroes in on these, like, black and white shoes. You go up these beautiful legs and you see this gorgeous dress. And finally, the camera reveals Betty Davis's face, but not her whole face, because she's wearing this fabulous, out of this world, like, white sun hat, okay, which goes over half of her face. You know, she has lipstick and she just looks gorgeous. And you're just like, wow, what happened? So she's there and she's standing at the top of the stairs. And she comes walking down the stairs and everyone's like, well, now we can get on with our tour. Now we can disembark the ship and get our drivers and things like this. And one of the tour guides comes running up to Betty Davis and says, Miss Bouchon, do you mind terribly? We had an odd number of tourists who are going on today's tour. And so we're doing everything in twos. And seeing as you're traveling by yourself, would you mind journeying with Paul Henreid, okay? And Paul Henreid, you know, has a cigarette, you know, and he's right there and he's French and he's dashing and he's fabulous. And it's like, who would have a problem doing a day tour with Paul Henreid? Answer, nobody. Okay, so it's like, would you mind having a day trip with Paul Henreid? Okay, so she's like, yes, okay. So because you can tell that she's attracted right away. And you can tell that he's attracted right away. You know, men in films in the 1940s do this way of doing this sort of thing where they lean in on one arm and look over something. But it's just there. OK, they know how to do it. And that's what he does. And so they go and they travel together to go and see the sights. And as they see the sights and are taken to the different villages and towns and things like this, there's small talk that begins to emerge. And they begin to ask questions and things like that about one another's background. And at one point he says, you know, and she's very restricted about hers. He's like, you know, Miss Bouchon, it's such a pleasure to meet with you. She actually says, my name is Vale. And he's like, oh, are you related to the Boston Vales? And she's like, one of the lesser ones, you know, it's basically one of the forgettable veils, you know. And he's like, so can I ask you what your name is, if it's not Renee? And she says, it's Charlotte Vale. And he's like, well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Charlotte Vale. And so they go and they do this town, this tour. And at one point he's like, he says, you know, oh, you know, maybe you can help me pick out a gift for my daughter. And so, like, you know, that was a hell of a thing to land. And he's like, so she's like, oh, daughter. And he's like, you know, my wife isn't very good at this. And she's like, oh, so you're married. But no, she's not reacting like that. She's being very Betty Davis and very Boston. And she's like, you know, and he's like, if I could ask you to help me pick out a gift for my daughter, that would be much better than me picking it up, because I think I would mess it up. And she's like, well, that's exactly what spinster aunts are wonderful. Though spinster aunts are wonderful at picking out gifts for young girls. You know, and so that's where she begins to really sort of show this side, this little bit of a brittle side on edge. And again, this is so Mars in Cancer. The feelings are hurt, but they're immediately covered up. There's probably an inner reprimand going on in her mind of like, you know, oh, I was such a fool to even been attracted to him. Of course, he's married and of course, he's got a daughter. And so, and of course, I can help him out because I'm the spinster aunt. And what does it matter if I'm dressed like this? I'm just always going to be a spinster aunt. I will never be this thing that this fake person I'm trying to present. It will always be the spinster aunt. And so there's an anger at herself, but there's also a brittleness and an anger at him, you know, and it's very Cancerian. Scorpio is famous for the sting, you know, but let's talk about the crab pinch. Okay, that claw does a, you know, comes out of the, and okay, and so it comes out. And again, it's meant to cover up the pain and to even deflect, you know. And because if he moves away, then that's going to prove what she suspects all along, which is that he could be easily discouraged. And that's how she's going to avoid rejection. But he doesn't. You know, he's very warm about it. He's very French. What do you want? But anyway, he's very warm about it and even a little bit amused. And he begins to sort of volunteer some information about his family. And he begins to talk about the daughter that they're going to be shopping for, Tina. And, you know, they go and they pick up something for Tina and they're sitting and they're talking. And he's like, would you like to see a picture of my family? And she's like, certainly. And so he shows her a picture and you see his wife who looks completely like battle axe. Okay. She looks completely severe and unfeeling. You see the older daughter who doesn't amount to anything in this plot. And then you see Tina. And Tina could virtually be a miniature version of spinster and Charlotte. Okay, she's got glasses. You know, she looks very unkempt and very shy and very retiring. And in that moment, Charlotte feels for Tina. She recognizes in Tina herself, and she feels for her, and she asks a little bit more. No, she says quite presciently, because this is a Mars in Cancer moment here. It's watery, right? She says quite presciently, because this is a watery moment. Mars is in Cancer and water signs always have this psychic ability to pick up the hidden information. She asks quite presciently, did your wife want Tina? And Jerry, that's his name. Jerry replies, well, what a curious question to ask. And she's like, did she want her? And he responds, no, she didn't. And basically in 1942-isms refers to the fact that the mother never wanted Tina at all and tried to get an abortion and wasn't able to. And so they had Tina, and Tina has basically known this ever since. And of course, what Charlotte hears in this story is her own story. Charlotte's father died when Charlotte was young, very young. She was taken in to see her father's body, or her father at the end of his life. And then, you know, he breathed his last and died. And the mother looked at Charlotte with scorn. I mean, there had always been scorn before, but now the scorn was explicit. So Charlotte knows all about not wanting. Charlotte knows all about being the unwanted child. And so it's in that moment that Charlotte says, well, would you like to see a picture of my family? And he's like, of course, you know. And so she takes out a picture of her family. This is another Mars in Cancer thing. It's the setup. It's the setup for the failure, okay? This is how Mars does it in Cancer, okay? I'm going to show you this. It's a test. You're going to blow it. And I'm going to become even more reinforced in my conviction that no good will come of this attraction, all right? So she shows, it's what we call a loaded moment. Okay, so she takes out of her purse a picture of her family, and Jerry looks at it, and he sees, you know, the mother. You can't miss her. And he's like, oh, that must be your mother. And then she's like, you know, and then he sees all these brothers and these brothers who are like 10 years older than Charlotte. Charlotte was born very late with their wives, and they're all very old and pale and severe looking. It's a Boston family, you know, what do you want? And then to one side, you know, and so that's the one that Jerry zeroes in on. And he's like, well, who's this chubby one? Is she you know, is she the maid or something like that? And it basically lets out a bit along the lines of who looks like that, right? And Charlotte, of course, responds, "That's me." And he's like, and she holds on to that moment. But what's really fantastic about the way that Bette Davis plays it is that she lets it go. You know, "That's me." He's mortified and embarrassed. Then she lets it go. And they continue with their conversation. And they continue with their tour, which they're clearly both enjoying quite a bit. And at one point, there's even an attempt to add 5 days to it. They get lost and they add 5 days to it that nobody knows about. And this is where she finds out he's unhappily married. He's not going to leave his wife. He's very concerned about his daughter, Tina, and he's very concerned about Tina's mental health. He feels horribly guilty about the animosity that the mother shows, and yet he's working very hard and in a job he doesn't like. What he wants to be is really an architect. And basically, he's kind of living this mirror life. He's kind of living this mirror life or recognizable life as being not too different from Charlotte's. And she has sympathy for that. And they fall in love, of course. And they love each other and they're close to each other and the best of friends. And she's supporting him and being an architect, saying, you can do it. Why don't you do this? You should pursue this. This is, you know, a great love of yours. And he feels emboldened and he feels very happy with her. And they never talk about the marriage because she's not going to split it up and he's not going to leave his wife. But they both know he's miserable in it. And he also knows that she's miserable in her family circumstance. So their lovely 6 days come to an end and they have to part. He has to fly back for a business engagement. She has to fly to catch the ship down in Buenos Aires or something like that. And what he does before she leaves is that he gives her gardenias. He gives her a branch of, well, they're really camellias. He gives her a branch of camellias, you know, and he says, "These are for you." And she smells them and she's so moved and she gets on the plane and they depart. And really that's the last they're going to see of each other. The cruise continues and she actually meets and gets to know, she had met them before, but she gets to know two friends of his. Who really fill in the backstory about how his wife is really quite emotionally abusive to him and makes him feel very small and little, and how they had feared that he was close to a nervous breakdown and that the wife really does a number on Tina, their daughter. And, you know, before they had left, Jerry had asked Charlotte what sanatorium she had gone to, what doctor she had seen. And she had recommended, of course, Dr. Jackwith. And so Jerry makes a note of that. Okay, so they come back to Boston, and she's back to Boston. And as Charlotte's sister-in-law and niece are there waiting for her, and they don't recognize this beautiful woman who's all decked out. Actually, the sister-in-law recognizes the beautiful woman who's all decked out because the sister-in-law provided all the beautiful gowns. There's no way that Charlotte was going to be able to dress like that on her own. And so the sister-in-law provided all of these beautiful gowns and evening wear for Charlotte to wear on the tour, along with little paper instructions on the gown of like what shoes go with what dresses and things like that. So this explains, of course, why Charlotte looked so fabulous and glamorous. And there's actually a moment where Jerry sees one of these instruction slips of paper pinned and he sees it. And she's like mortified, but he's so good humored and loving. And he's like, you know, "You're who you are." And so, you know, that's really where their friendship had budded. She was trying to present someone that she's not, but he was already responding to who she is, the whole Charlotte. It's not Charlotte underneath, but the Charlotte who is emerging. And this is, again, the wonderful thing about the performance in the film is that at no point does Charlotte sort of like master all of this. You see the insecurities, you see the frailty. She will often break down and say, you know, to Jerry, "I can't, you know, I'm not this person. I don't know what you see in me." And he's like, he turns the conversation back to their friendship. And so it's always very reassuring and it's always very supportive. And because she looks like this to all the passengers on the ship, they've really kind of supported this narrative that Charlotte has presented of being Renee Bouchon, you know. And so she's the most popular woman on the boat. When she disembarks, the niece doesn't recognize her. The sister-in-law, who is delighted. There's a polo player who's famous in New York, who's getting her bags, and another doctor who is giving her his address, and everyone's like, you know, here are addresses and things like this. And she's collecting them at the end. And this is, it's a wonderful moment of triumph. She's gone from, you know, the monkey that was being tortured and tormented to this elegant, really beautiful woman. And so it's here that we are ready to go back home. It's here that we're ready to go back home. The sister-in-law has collected Charlotte and is going to take her back home. And so they come back home, and the sister-in-law says, do you want me to come on in with you? And Charlotte says, no, I need to face mother on my own. I'll see you tonight at the dinner party. They're having a dinner party for the family to welcome Charlotte back home. And so she comes back home, and there's a nurse who's attending her mother, who's been ill, of course, the entire time that Charlotte has been away, you know, complaining of heart trouble, which she has, but it's been diagnosed as being okay. And so the nurse says, well, your mother wants to see you, and she's in a mood, you know. And so she's like, it's fine, I understand. And so she goes up to see her mother, and her mother's sitting in the rocker, you know, just facing the door, waiting for Charlotte to come in. And she's like, it's worse than I feared. You know, and Charlotte looks gorgeous. You know, she's like, it's worse than I feared. Your appearance is a travesty, you know, and she begins immediately demoting, disparaging Charlotte's appearance and going about plans for that evening, how the family is coming back to celebrate her return. And that in order to do this, obviously, she's going to take that makeup off. The hair is fine. The hair is okay for tonight. It can be grown out eventually. And she needs to take back her natural look. Her eyebrows were fine before. She doesn't understand why they're trimmed right now. And so because they have to sort of think spontaneously about tonight, you know, you're going to take off those ridiculous clothes and you're going to put on your black and white foulard, you know. And so she's like, black and white foulard. And she's like, yes, you're going to wear your black and white foulard, you know, with this kind of malice. Okay, the Saturnian, okay, you're getting it, the Saturnian malice that's coming from the mother. And actually, Charlotte is really quite diplomatic about it. She says, all right, and she leaves, and they reunite right before dinner that night. The mother comes in to inspect to see that Charlotte is, and Charlotte isn't. Charlotte emerges in this beautiful black dress, with a wrap around the waist. It's so fabulous. Anyway, she emerges in this beautiful black dress, and the mother's like, you know, what are you doing wearing that? You were going to wear your black and white foulard, you know? And she's like, oh, mother, let's not quarrel. And the mother's just sort of like this. And it's a great moment in the scene. She exits for a moment in the dress, and there's a close-up on the mother's. It's shot from behind the mother. And so there's a close-up on her finger, like tapping on the bedpost as Charlotte is saying, let's not quarrel. Let's get along. Let's meet each other halfway or whatever. And you just see this hand tapping on the bedpost. You know? And the mother is supporting her on the bedpost, waiting for Charlotte to reemerge. And she does. And she takes out a box and she opens this box. And in the box are camellias, they're flowers. And so the mother's like, who's, you know, where are those flowers from? And she's like, oh, they're from New York. And she's like, well, who sent them? Where are the flowers from in New York? Well, there's a florist called whatever. I mean, she's not answering who it is. And the mother's like, well, I suppose you're not going to tell me who it is. And she's like, mother, no, I'm not going to tell you who it is. And, you know, she puts on the brocade, like she puts on the flowers like this, and she's ready to go on down. And the mother begins immediately with, well, let's see how you're going to do if you continue wearing these clothes. Oh, no, she says, well, how did you buy these clothes? And she's like, well, I bought them from my allowance. Who supplies you with this allowance? You do, mother. And you expect to continue for me to continue to supply you with this allowance? Money used as a weapon, very Mars and water. Okay. You expect me and Earth signs Sorry, got a cop to it. Okay. You expect me to continue supplying you with an allowance so you can buy these disgraceful clothes? That's not going to happen. And she's like, okay. And then she says, so what are you going to do without the money? Right now, Charlotte Vale, you are the major inheritor of my fortune. What are you going to do without this money? And she's like, well, I've saved up $5,000 of my own so I could get a job and maybe use that to get my own place. And $5,000 won't get you very far. And she's like, well, then I'll have to make do in some way. And the mother says, I guess you'll be laughing out of the other side of your mouth if I actually did carry out my threat. And Charlotte responds with, I don't think I would. I'm not afraid, mother. And she stops and she says, I'm not afraid. And then she looks at her mother and she says, I'm not afraid, mother. And it's this amazing moment of radiance. It's this amazing moment of revelation. She says to her mother, I am not afraid. And this is the beauty of the Mars and Saturn trine, the fighting, the struggle for control. It never really stops in their relationship. But what's really wonderful about Gladys Cooper's performance, as well as Bette Davis's, is that there is this mother-daughter bond. You know, Gladys Cooper doesn't play the mother like the Wicked Witch of the West. Okay, there is this bond. There is this, the mother isn't understanding. The mother doesn't have to understand, but she does care for her daughter. You know, it's there underneath. And Charlotte does care for her mother, but she doesn't want to be the indentured servant, you know, to her mother. They need to find somewhere where they can meet halfway. But that's not what the scene is about. The scene is about her turning to her mother and saying, I am not afraid, mother. I'm not afraid. I am not afraid, mother. And it's not defiant. It's radiant. It's calling on this inner strength. Calling on strengths you didn't know you had. Calling on an inner radiance. That comes from the malefics. The malefics are outfitted to get you through what's hard and troubled and difficult about your life. The malefics, if they're entrined in sextile in your chart, are there to outfit you to get you through what's difficult. But it's only by facing the difficulty that you can call upon their power, that you can call upon them as a resource. And again, it's not done in an angry fighting way or, you know, whatever, mother. It's done in this affirmation. It's done in this affirmation. And you also get, not in their words, but in their way that they are with one another, a care about one another, that there is something underneath, that this cold mother isn't completely indifferent and this embattled daughter isn't completely unsupported. And so they leave this moment. The mother stays upstairs. She's ill. She can't go downstairs. And so Charlotte's going to go downstairs and send each of the family members up to say hello. And so it's the mother's way of sulking and calling attention to herself. And Charlotte's gone and sort of lit the fire in the living room. And everyone's like, the fire's never been lit in the living room. And she's like, well, it's about time it had. I mean, what do you want? Bette Davis is an Aries. She's going to light the fire in the hearth that's never been lit. You know, and it's a Mars in Cancer. Let's light that fire in the hearth, you know, that hasn't been lit. And over the evening, she wins over her relatives. At first, they're completely shocked that she looks like this. And you totally see the sister-in-law who was the inspiration for the unibrow. But they're won over and they have a delightful time. And the mother is kind of unnerved by the fact that they're laughing and having a fun time. You know, and so this changes not the power dynamic, but it changes the conversation between the mother and the daughter. That she looked her mother in the eye and she didn't blink, but she didn't spit in her mother's eye either. She affirmed who she is, and the mother recognizes this. Well, also at this party is I think his name is Elliot Livingston, you know, the most eligible bachelor in Boston, who, you know, takes a fancy to Charlotte. You know, he's like, he doesn't do that thing that Paul Henri does. He just takes a fancy. Okay, like that. Secondary romantic male lead characters are like, you know, where's the, you know, they do that. They're like, takes a fancy, you know, to Charlotte. And so basically she ends the evening having scored the interest or having scored a date with Elliot Livingston, the most eligible family in Boston. And of course, the mother changes her tune in an instant. She's all for it. She wants to see them get married. And so they date for a number of months, actually. And the mother and Charlotte actually have this wonderful truce where they're having conversation. And they kind of like poke each other in a very humorous way. I mean, it's funny, actually. And you kind of really see the way that the relationship could be, right? But what happens, of course, is that she, you know, attends a pre-concert party or whatever with Livingston, her fiance. And it's Boston society and things like this. And someone at the party says, oh, let me introduce you to this fellow or whatever. And of course, it's Jerry. And Jerry has taken up architecture. He switched his career, took up architecture. He's very demand and very much in demand. He's very talented, very much in demand in Boston society. And now he's being celebrated. And he sees her, she sees him, and they have a very quick, intimate conversation where she's like, I never thought I'd see you again. And he's like, I can't tell you how many times I wanted to ring the bell of your house. I've walked by your house on that street so many times. And she's like, why didn't you? And he's like, I didn't know that you, I mean, I heard that you've been engaged, you're engaged to be married. And she's like, you know, and so they're kind of constrained by their roles, their social roles. They go to the concert. And of course, at the concert, she's sitting between her fiance and Jerry, you know, and she looks at Jerry, Jerry looks at her, and they make an agreement to maybe meet very quickly that night. It's really the heiress again, okay, where this is the climatic scene where the fortune hunter is going to meet the heiress and confess his feelings and things like that. But what happens here that's different from the heiress is that he doesn't show up or he doesn't come to call. And she's heartbroken and things like this. And she rushes off to the train station to see him as he's just about to get on the train. And she's like, why didn't you? And he's like, you're engaged to be married. I'm not going to see you throw away your happiness for me. I'm stuck in a situation. I'm stuck on a boat that's going nowhere. And I'm not going to see you throw away your happiness for me. I want you to marry this fellow. I want you to have a life. You deserve it. And please, please do this. And she's like, I can't. And he's like, I want you to. And so he leaves on the train. And so you hear the Saturn and Pisces, you know, and on both sides, which is they're going to make this supreme sacrifice to live lives that are making them miserable. And what's again, remember, it's Mars and Cancer trining the Saturn and Pisces. She, you know, it's all put in front of her. All she has to do is marry this guy. And he's a handsome guy and he's got lots of money and she'll be respected in society. She'll have her independence. She will have her mother's approval. All right. But it's Mars. It's Mars in Cancer. It can't settle in to these Cancerian expectations. Okay. Mars is going to take one or two positions being in the astrological sign of Cancer. It's either going to reinforce everything about Cancer that's home and hearth and family, or it's going to fight against it. Okay, it's going to do one of the two. And so this is what happens. She makes an appointment to meet with her fiance, Elliot Livingston, a couple of days later, and she begins a conversation, which you can tell it's the breakup conversation, and he can tell it's the breakup conversation. And they're both pretty much fessing up to the fact that they're not really meant to be with each other. What's fascinating about this film and that it was made in 1942 is that she makes references to actually them being sexually incompatible in this conversation. It's very veiled, but it's there. And, you know, she says, you know, would you take me out to different clubs? Would you take me out to different places? Would we be close to one another? Would we? And she's basically implying, you know, would we be more, you know, could we be more bohemian? Could we be more sexual? You know, and she talks about wanting a child and he's like, I already have two sons and they're grown. And, you know, so she's seeing that she would marry him, become the wife, the stepmother of two sons, take up this spinster aunt role again and not have a sex life or have a child because he's not really into it. And so this is really brought up, and they both veiled, you know, indirectly, and they both decide that it's, you know, they're better off not marrying, and he wishes her luck and she wishes him luck. And of course, she has to go upstairs and tell her mother. Okay, it's always going back to that. She has to go upstairs and tell her mother, Mars in Cancer. She has to go upstairs and tell her mother about what's happened. And her mother immediately goes back to the old script. She goes back to, you know, being tyrannical and biting and domineering and bringing up the money thing and how she blew it and how she's going to be, you know, the old maid spinster of Boston, the laughing stock. I mean, it's really, really cruel what she says. And Betty Davis sits down on a reclining rocker and she's rocking back and forth in place. And the mother kind of exhausts herself with this vehemence, okay? And then Charlotte says, Dr. Jackwith said that tyranny is sometimes an expression of the maternal instinct. And if that's a mother's love, then I want no part of it. And she gets up out of the chair and she's so upset and she crosses over to the door and she says, and her back is to her mother. And she says, I didn't want to be born and you didn't want me to be born either. It's been a calamity on both sides. You know, and these are harsh words. And Gladys Cooper, the mother, hears them. And all of a sudden she clutches at her heart and she just very quietly slumps into her chair. And at that moment, Betty Davis at the door with her back to the mother says, Oh, mother, let's not quarrel. We've been getting along together. So Betty Davis stops at the door and she says, Oh, mother, let's not quarrel. We've been getting along together so well lately, and it was a horrid, and she turns around to say, horrid. And she sees her mother slumped in the chair. And she goes to her mother in the chair. And she turns and she calls out for the nurse. And the nurse shows up and she's like, what? Oh, and nurse immediately goes to go vitals. And she's like, it's my fault. It's all my fault.
We quarreled.
I said things I should never have said. It's all my fault. And so you just hear, it's all my fault. It's all my fault. It's all my fault. So again, this Mars in Cancer is coming out. It's unrelenting in its accusation. You know, it's all your fault. Your mother's dead because of you. You know, and she just hears this and we go very quickly. There's a reading of the will. And of course, she inherits all of the will. I think like each of the brothers gets $3,000 or something like that. She gets all of the will. And she flees the house and she goes to the sanitarium. She goes to the sanitarium to seek out Dr. Jackwith because she's convinced that she's about to have a nervous breakdown. And it's all her fault. And she gets there and her nurse is there and she's like, shall I take you to your room? And she's like, yes, please. I just want to lie down in bed. I just want to. And she looks over, she's crossing the living room of the sanitarium, and her eye spots immediately a young girl who can't be any older than 13. You know, and she looks, and the girl has glasses, and her hair is down and in front of her face, and she's working on a puzzle. And the nurse is like, I can take you up to your room now. And she's like, no, just one moment. And she goes and she sees this girl and she sits down with this girl. And she's like, well, what are you doing? And she's like, well, I'm not telling you. You know, Mars in Cancer continues. Okay. I'm not telling you. You know, it's a surly response. And she's like, well, it looks like you're making a puzzle. What piece shall we start with? And the girl's like, are you one of those nurses? Are you my new nurse? And she's like, no, I'm a friend. You're saying you're a friend because you're just a nurse. And she's like, no, I'm a friend. Now, what shall we do? Shall I collect all the pink pieces and you collect the blue pieces? and we'll sit down and we can make this puzzle together. And the girl's like, you really want to make this puzzle with me? And she's like, of course. And she's like, okay. And so they work on the puzzle for a few moments. And the girl says, what's your name? And she says, you can call me Camille. Camille, by the way, happens to have been a nickname that Jerry had given her on their travels. Water signs always coming up with different aliases and names for themselves. But anyway, that you can call me Camille. And she says, what's your name? And she says, Christina. And they make the puzzle together. Well, obviously, over the course of time, she figures out pretty quickly that this is Tina, that this is Jerry's daughter, and that he had been sent, that Jerry had followed her recommendation on sending Tina to the sanitarium. And Charlotte, of course, wants to spend all of her time with Tina. And this is breaking the rules. And Dr. Jackwith, you know, sort of has to say, well, you're kind of like breaking the rules. She's got a nurse and things like that. And she's like, what she needs is a mother's love. And it's fascinating because Charlotte's not a mother. I mean, yes, Tina needs a mother's love, but her mother has been very cold and abusive. Charlotte's not a mother. She's a spinster aunt. They're supposed to be doing things like picking out gifts for other people's daughters. You know, they're not supposed to be this, which is mothering. And what you see in their blossoming friendship, their flowering relationship between Tina and Charlotte, is Charlotte's love and generosity and companionship to Tina makes Tina, it's healing. It makes Tina feel wanted, makes Tina feel like she belongs. It makes Tina feel valued. And so this is what's going on. At the same time, Charlotte is healing her wounded child, not because it was an assignment or something to do. She just, this love comes forth from her. And at the same time, she's healing her grief over her mother. You know, none of this is said, but you can see that it's healing the grief over her mother, that she's understanding what it's like to mother and be there for someone. And then she's also healing the wounded child in herself. And it's really lovely what happens, this bond. And of course, it comes out that you know, she's Paul and Reed's daughter, Jerry's daughter, and she actually even gets on the phone with Jerry, you know, who's like, are you sure you want to be spending this much time? And she's like, Jerry, it makes me so happy. You know, and it does. And the doctor even, you know, and so the two of them create this bond where they're really together, and they've healed one another's wounds, are in the process of healing one another's wounds. This is what's drawn these two older woman, younger woman, really surrogate mother, surrogate daughter together into one another's orbit. And so the film ends with Charlotte having a get-together at her party. Dr. Jackwith has showed up. Charlotte is on the board of directors, and he's shown up to show the blueprints of the wing, or the three wings that Charlotte will be building. And of course, the architect is Jerry, you know. But Tina's come to live with Charlotte at her house. Tina's no longer living with her mother. Tina's now living with Charlotte, again, to create this space, this sanctuary, this sort of safe space. And again, what you see is the Saturn in Pisces, the child left at the church doorstep, you know, background of Charlotte and Tina, these unwanted children in which the parents have not been subtle about it. So now Tina lives with Charlotte in this mansion. Charlotte has friends over, and the niece's friends over, and they laugh and they carouse. And actually, at this party, they're roasting weenies in the big fireplace. It's very funny and cute. And having potato chips. There's nothing formal or stuffy about this dinner party. It's lots of fun. And Jerry shows up. And Jerry asks to speak with Charlotte. And so they depart. They go into a drawing room. And Jerry's basically saying, I don't want to unload my daughter on you. I don't want you sacrificing your life to live like this. And she's hurt by what he's saying. And she's like, what? Is that the way you've always seen me? As some sort of woman who like only a man can complete her is basically what she's saying. I thought we had an understanding in our relationship. And he said, well, our understanding, as I understood it, is I can never give you what you want. You know, I can't leave my wife. And she's basically, but you have given something that I want. You've given me your child, you know, that I can care for your child. And he's like, well, you're not going to spend the rest of your life caring for the child. And she's like, what's wrong with that is essentially what she's saying. I mean, your child is blossoming. I'm blossoming as a result. You know, what's wrong with that? You know, and he's feeling bad and guilty and pretty much, you know, like he's not providing a home for his daughter, that it has to be provided by this woman that he loves, that this woman that he loves is kind of being put on hold, meaning she can't marry because she's carrying this and taking care of his responsibilities and burdens. And he feels horribly guilty and bad about it. And she's amazed that he doesn't really understand that this is about love. And she says to him, you were my first friend. You were my first friend. And out of that friendship blossomed love. And this is something that's very special. This is something that's very sacred to the two of us, this love. And he's like, yes. You know, he doesn't know what else to say. And then, of course, she says, oh, Jerry, don't let's ask for the moon when we have the stars. And it's a beautiful line. Oh, Jerry, don't let's ask for the moon. We have the stars, and the camera pans up to the moon and then to the stars beyond it. And it's such an extraordinary line. Obviously, it's a very melodramatic line. You know, let's not ask for the moon. We have the stars. You know, don't let's limit us to that. But this is what she's saying. Let's not limit ourselves to the moon. Let's not limit ourselves to this traditional upbringing. Let's not force ourselves back into these social expectations, these cultural expectations that have put you in a miserable marriage where you can't divorce your wife, that made me a spinster aunt, and my only option was, even when I transformed myself, was to marry. And I don't want to marry, okay? I mean, she's Charlotte Vale of Boston. She has all of this money. She doesn't have to marry. And she can do the thing that she wants to do, which is to provide a home for a child that was not loved, and to contribute money and help build a spiritual, it's called a sanitarium, it's psychological, but it's really a spiritual refuge or sanctuary for people with broken hearts and broken souls to go and mend. So this is, you know, it's like, why are we settling for the moon when we have the stars, which is very Aquarius, of course, when we have all these different possibilities, when we have all of these different alternatives, you know, let's go with that, you know. And of course, you know, he does. He's going to go with that. You know, it's going to be this completely unconventional relationship that exists between the two of them, and that is actually going to make them both, you can tell, very, very happy. So, in closing, to return to that poem, the untold want by life and land never granted. Now, Voyager, sail forth to seek and find. Leave the landlocked lifestyle. Leave the landlocked expectations, the landlocked culture. Leave that. You know, and this is so Walt Whitman, you know, who was so optimistic. Now, Voyager, sail forth. Sail forth to seek and find. Sail forth to seek and find your life. You know, on a ship guided by the stars, go and seek and find. That is the message of the poem. And the message of this trine, of this transit, is the opportunity to build in the future what was lost in the past.
Every day, people around the globe turn to astrology to find inner peace and fulfillment, gain a deeper understanding of themselves and others, and navigate the tricky and complex world around them, only to be left lost and confused by resources that demand too much of their time, energy, and brain power. Because no matter how much you focus or commit to learning about astrology, you're trying to decipher the world's largest encyclopedia. And while learning astrology isn't supposed to be simple, it's a whole lot easier when you can tap into the minds of the world's best astrology experts and a community of like-minded souls who are here to support you on your journey. That's where we come in. Welcome to Astrology Hub's Inner Circle, home for curious newbies, devoted enthusiasts, and anyone looking to use astrology to consciously navigate their path ahead and transform their lives. Inner Circle members get exclusive access to new astrologer guides each month to lead you through different astrological topics and perspectives, detailed live new moon and full moon forecasts to guide you through the lunar cycle and work with the cosmic tides, a new mastery class each month teaching a different astrological technique so you can gain confidence in your chart reading skills, monthly live chart demos and Q&A with astrologer guides with a chance to submit your chart to be used as an example, and access to our private community where you can discuss the cosmic tides, share your art and creativity, ask questions about your chart, and share insights and resources with your fellow students. Plus, exclusive bonus supporting content, including a live new moon intention setting ceremony each month, daily text cosmic updates on important transits and energies, and bonus mastery classes on the part of fortune and spirit with Donna Woodwell, retrograde planets with Michelle Dench, and the Galactic Center with Julia Balas. The Inner Circle community is the place for anyone hungry for meaningful connection with other students of astrology, and enrollment is currently open for new students. We know that everyone has their own unique path to discovery. The Inner Circle will meet you where you're at and give you the tools to get where you want to go with our step-by-step learning path guide. We may be all different and on our own paths, but we're all under the same sky. And our community is home to thousands of people united in our individuality and shared journey of discovery. Go to astrologyhub.com/IC23 to learn more. I really hope that you'll join us on the inside.